listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
First, you see signs of homesickness, then maybe a bit of anxiety, some compulsive behavior, and if things get really bad, addiction, maybe even an eating disorder. We all know someone who's dealt with this, perhaps even ourselves, but did we know that these ailments affect our furry friends too? It's the animals who take center stage tonight, thanks to the extensive research and field work conducted by tonight's authors, who will entertain and intrigue us with their fascinating findings from the lives of animals all around the world. In her moving new book, Animal Madness, Dr. Laurel Brightman explores how mental illness affects the animal kingdom in many of the same ways it affects us, humans. She argues that if we manage to make a lasting peace with Darwin's belief that humans are just another kind of animal, different only by degree, we could develop a deeper compassion for them and, in turn, ourselves. In addition to holding a doctorate in the history of science from MIT, Brightman is also a senior TED Fellow and contributing writer for Pop-Up Magazine, among other publications. Sharing the stage with her tonight are Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, co-authors of the New York Times bestseller Zubiquity, who've taken a fascinating look at the physical ailments suffered by animals and how a pan-species approach to medicine can heal not just our animal friends, but can inform and grow our understanding of ourselves. Zubiquity is a clever mashup of the words zoology and ubiquity, encouraging us to see ourselves in other animals and finding the animal in ourselves. Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz is a cardiology professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and serves on the medical advisory board of the Los Angeles Zoo as a cardiovascular consultant. Co-author Catherine Bowers is a former staff editor at The Atlantic and was a writer and producer at CNN International. She's taught writing at UCLA and is currently a fellow at the New America Foundation. Leading our authors in conversation tonight is Sandin Totten, KPCC's science reporter and co-producer of Brains On, a podcast for kids and curious adults about the scientific mysteries of the universe. So please join me in welcoming all of them to the Aloud stage at the Los Angeles Public Library.
All right, welcome everybody. Thanks for joining us for this, what I'm sure will be a fascinating discussion. I want to start with a little audience participation. Quick round of applause. Who here lives with an animal? Okay, that's good. That's good. That was a trick question for those of you who didn't clap. If you live with anybody, whether that's dog, parrot, or person, you actually live with an animal. And I want you to keep that in mind because our discussion today is going to span all the different kinds of animals out there, from our pets to people you may know, and kind of what we can learn from each other. So I'm going to start by just letting us kind of warm up a little bit here. We're going to do a little bit of an exercise. It'll give you a chance to get to know our guests. We're going to start with something called word association. I'm sure you've all played this before. So it basically works like this. I'm going to say a word. You're going to say the first thing that comes into your mind. No pressure. We'll start with Laurel.
I'm not feeling any pressure, by the
way. Anything that just pops into your mind. Dog.
Anxiety.
Fair enough. Cat, Laurel.
Judgy.
Okay. Oh, can I say something?
Well, you'll get yours in a second. Well, catch.
Can I? Bully.
Bully.
Oh, but I love them.
You just lost half the room.
Last one for you. Dolphin.
Oh, sexual.
Great. It's going to be a good conversation. Catherine, lemur.
close to human.
Okay. Elephant.
Powerful.
Dragonfly.
Dragonfly, also almost human.
Oh, interesting. Barbara, monkey.
Brilliant.
Humans?
Monkey.
Sasquatch.
Fascinating.
Diplomatically put. So now that we're all warmed up, let's talk animals and illnesses. Both of your books, Animal Madness and Zubiquity, start kind of with one animal that opened up your minds to the larger issues at hand here. So we'll start with Laurel. Your book, Animal Madness, starts with the love of your life. His name is Oliver. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him and how he kind of led you to this topic?
Sure. Oliver was a Bernese Mountain Dog, and he was beautiful. And like so many relationships, when you start, you know, everything is wine and roses. And maybe 6 months in, yeah, you realize what you've actually fallen in love with. And that was the case with me. And it was like in many of my human relationships, it was too late. I loved him.
You already loved him, right?
Exactly.
Not too late to get out.
No, I mean, you know, I think about this often, which is, you know, you don't take the person back to the bar in which you met them. You know, I mean, I could have returned him, but I wouldn't have. In trying to help him, it really cracked open my mind. I'd never experienced life with a creature that could be that anxious, human or otherwise. And it really made me reevaluate what I thought previously was deeply anthropomorphic or really projecting my own emotional states onto his, but in fact that wasn't true.
Can you tell us a little bit about his anxiety, how it manifested, and how similar you think it looked to what we call human anxiety?
Sure. Yeah, he could not be left alone. He would devolve into an absolutely crippling panic anytime that we left the house, unless we left on a really strict schedule. But he dug up our wooden floors, he gnawed through two wooden doors, he panted, he ran back and forth, he would watch me window to window until he disappeared, and then he would howl. It really culminated in once we left him alone for 2 hours with someone that he cared about deeply, who was our downstairs neighbor, who was dog sitting. And he pushed a window air conditioning unit out of the way. He chewed through a metal screen and he jumped out of our window. And we lived on the third floor of a brownstone. And he survived, you know, miraculously. But that's just a tiny bit of what he was capable of. And he was 120 pounds. So that's really similar to a person at that size, you know, experiencing a panic attack. Really.
Right. So this showed you kind of there was more going on, I guess, in the inner life of your dog than you had thought.
Yeah. And I wish I could say, you know, it came out of a deep-seated intellectual curiosity or something. But actually, you know, it was really practical. It was, how do I keep my dog from hurting himself and destroying, you know, we were renters.
It all comes down to
it
that.
It was also terrible that way, you know. I mean, I couldn't afford. I was working as a conservationist. I had no money. And my ex-husband was a geologist. We couldn't afford to constantly be redoing the house and replacing wooden doors.
Right.
So it was partly that, too, which is like, how do we protect him and how do we protect our house?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so we'll talk more about your findings in a bit. But now, Barbara, your journey to the Zubiquitous Road to your book started, you know, as you were working, you know, as a cardiologist, and you were asked to do some stuff at the zoo once in a while to work with various animals. You met someone named Spitz Buben?
Mm-hmm.
And he taught you something. Who is he, and what did you learn from him?
So Spitz Buben was a she.
She.
And she was a tamarin, a beautiful, you know, Central and South American monkeys. They're these little, tiny, very beautiful animals. They live at the top of the canopy of the rainforest. And, you know, the LA Zoo, so, you know, zoos are staffed by very qualified veterinarians. They're board certified. But once in a while, they ask human experts for help with subspecialty care. And I was just like the lucky cardiologist at UCLA who got that call. And so one day I came to see Spitz Buben. They wanted me to do an ultrasound on her heart. And as I was coming to image her, get closer and closer to her, I was making eye contact, and the way I would do with a human patient, to connect with them, make them feel at ease. And as I got closer and was really locking eyes, the veterinarian, I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I was told to back off, that I was scaring her, and that I might give her something called capture myopathy. So for the physicians or nurses in the room, myopathy is a muscle disease. And, you know, as a cardiologist, For decades, I knew what myopathy was, but I'd never heard about capture myopathy. And it turns out veterinarians and wildlife biologists and animal experts have known that species of animals, from monkeys to shorebirds
to rabbits, to deer and elk, sometimes, not frequently, but sometimes when they're terrified and restrained, they can have this flood of adrenaline which poisons the muscles of their body, sometimes even the heart, and can actually lead to their death. And this was fascinating to me as a human doctor. I knew at that point very little about veterinary medicine, but what was just a kind of an epiphany was it triggered immediately a connection to what had been a new human diagnosis. Around the year 2000, some Japanese cardiologists reported on this fascinating, rare new syndrome that a human could be scared to death. And so as I thought about capture myopathy and I thought about this syndrome of being scared to death that these cardiologists had reported, I realized that it was new. And in that moment, I thought, my goodness, here, you know, humans, we think we're so special, you know, the top of the food chain. And we knew nothing about this diagnosis. And yet these animal experts not only knew about this in this wide range of animals, they had been treating it and actually preventing it. So that was a real aha epiphany moment.
It was sort of like scratching the surface and realizing there was all this treasure of information hidden in the animal kingdom that doctors who study just humans might have been missing.
Yeah, and frankly, that there was a kind of snobbery about thinking about veterinarians. I mean, all physicians, in a sense, we're all veterinarians. You know, physicians just specialize in one species.
Right, there's a joke you told me once.
Yeah, that's the joke.
What do you call a veterinarian who just specializes in one species? Is that it?
A physician, yeah.
But anyway.
So yeah, that was the insight that if physicians could just, and nurses and people who take care of humans could just open up and think about these experts who spend their lives taking care of other non-human animals, we could learn a lot.
Right. So Catherine, I'll turn it to you. This led you and Barbara to kind of team up to write this book, Zoobiquity. And I remember you once explaining it as a series of questions that were basically, do animals get X? So tell us about some of those X's and what were they and what did you guys find?
Well, what you were just describing is this idea that there's this parallel world of human medicine on one side and animal medicine as if we aren't part of that and as if it's humans here and everything else on the other side. So it was kind of a fun opportunity to just say, do animals get heart disease? Do animals get cancer? Do animals get anxious under pressure? Do animals get sexually transmitted diseases? Do animals get nutritional issues? Do they have other kinds of challenges in their lives? And every time we asked one of those questions, the answer was yes. And we started off with in the sort of physical realm, the big things that scare most of us medically. And when those answers all came back yes, we decided to branch out a little bit. And we started, Barbara trained in psychiatry, and we also looked at psychiatric issues, like do animals have eating disorders? Do they have adolescent risk-taking? Do they have separation anxiety, like you've described? Do they have addiction issues or substance use leanings? And again, the answers all came back yes. And that's when we really felt like we had to write this.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating look at all these things. You sort of almost, it felt like when I was reading, you're almost deprived of these things you thought were so uniquely human. I mean, they're all problems, you know, they're mental disorders or sexual dysfunctions or things, but you assume, oh, that's just human. Only humans would do that. And you find out, no, horses do that, pigs do that.
That was a big revelation for me, actually, was to kind of stop thinking of myself as so separate from the rest of all of life on Earth. And yeah. I found it profoundly connecting to think of that we as humans are not alone in not just our physical challenges, but also our emotional, mental challenges.
Well, let's move on to that, because one thing both of you talk about in your books is that animals share a lot of mental disorders, like anxiety, panic attacks, obsessive compulsive disorder, or I guess it's just compulsive disorder in animals, because we can't really explain whether or not they're being obsessive. But let's talk a little bit about how you guys have found these different symptoms manifesting in the animal kingdom. Laura, why don't you talk about one that you, a mental disorder that really stood out to you as being different, but also the same?
Well, I actually, I wouldn't say, you know, that OCD, say, in the animal kingdom is exactly the same as it is among humans. And I know you guys are really careful about those kinds of questions also. I think species matters. But when you look particularly at lots of different forms of mental disorders, they tend to be very normal human activities gone awry in a lot of ways, which are really normal, healthy animal activities. So, you know, what I quickly realized was, like, looking at a lot of OCD behaviors are really grooming behaviors gone awry or gone too intense. You know, whether we're washing our hands or paws, you know, most of us can pluck our hair or our fur or our feathers. So OCD or compulsive disorders end up to be found really throughout the animal kingdom. It just depends on the species. You know, whatever you do as a species is usually what you tend to do compulsively.
Right.
So if you...
And often as a way of calming yourself.
Exactly.
And so this thing that you do to soothe yourself in the moment gets dialed up when you're anxious, and it goes far enough to hurt you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can, like, chew my cuticles when I'm stressed out, or I twirl my hair, and, like, I kept coming across gorillas who were gnawing on their fingers, you know, or twirling their fur, but then they would, you know, begin to pluck it. And then I took Mass General has a hair plucking scale. I don't know if you guys have where hair twirling is actually on it, I found out. It's all a continuum, and we were all on it, you know, and so I very quickly realized, like, oh, you know, I'm not a physician, but I imagine, you know, when you're studying for the boards and, you know, you begin to feel that you have so many things. That was also an experience of mine while writing this.
One story I remember you talk about in your book is about a famous polar bear named Gus who manifested his OCD by swimming. Can you explain that?
Sure. Pattern swimming behavior is a behavior that lots of creatures who swim can end up with. Just like, you know, if you go to the zoo and you see, like, they almost become like topo maps, you know, of the compulsive mind, where you'll see, like, a bear who is worn in a perfect infinity symbol in his enclosure. But yeah, Gus did that in the water. And to the zoo's great credit, they hired a behaviorist to come in and help him, and it actually made a pretty big difference. When I visited Gus a few years later, he was eating, you know, bear takeout. They would put meat in bags for him to maul so he had something to do. They gave him traffic cones so he could knock them over. He was on Prozac for a short time. So...
So I wanted to turn to the Zubiquity team here. One characteristic of mental disorder you talked about in your book that stood out to me was cutting, which is something that is kind of often hard to understand even in humans. And yet you found an animal counterpart a little bit that kind of helps explain the behavior. Why don't you talk about kind of, first of all, what is cutting for people who don't know in humans, and then how does it manifest in the animal kingdom as well?
Right. So the term cutting is colloquial, but it refers to, you know, self-injury, varying forms of self-injury. So the most iconic form is really when an individual takes an object, often a razor or a knife or something sharp, and actually cuts their skin. And I remember when Catherine and I were just beginning to work on this book, and we thought we were going to write about the overlap of human and animal diseases, and we were a little skittish about looking at the psychiatric. We weren't sure. We wanted this to be very scientifically credible. But I was in a cardiology clinic one day, and a young woman had come in with palpitations. And as I put my stethoscope over her chest and I was listening to her heart, I noticed that on the inside of her left forearm, she had these well-healed scars. And I recognized that was a very common cutting pattern. And I asked her about it. And she said something to me, which a lot of cutting patients, self-injuring patients, said. I asked her, I said, why do you do it? You know, what do you get out of it? And she said, you know, it's weird, but it gives me a sense of release. It's a relief. It calms me. And you hear many self-injuring humans describe that calming, relieving sense, which seems so paradoxical that would happen. But I remember Catherine and I went home, we started talking about this issue, and we thought, well, we'll ask our veterinary experts, do animals self-injure? At that time, we didn't know. And of course, as Laurel knows, it's extremely common across the animal kingdom. And it's interesting when you talk to veterinarians who deal with some birds, for example, who take their talon or their beaks and they peck at their skin until it bleeds, or pull at it, or pluck out feathers until it bleeds. And you ask why the animals are doing it, the veterinarians, the animal experts know it seems to be an attempt by the animal to soothe themselves. And that was when that connection between animal self-injury and human-animal self-injury really was made by us.
And then what we tried to do was look at what the veterinarians know that the human physicians might not know. And since vets see it so often, they do have ways of treating those issues that physicians don't know about. Like, they identify stress, isolation, and boredom as real triggers for these behaviors where an animal is trying to self-soothe and it tips over into damaging behavior. And so they'll do things like give the animal a companion. If it's, say, a flank-biting horse that's biting its flank, they'll put a little chicken in the stall, or they'll return it literally to its herd in a more sort of natural grouping where that horse has companionship and is sort of feeding throughout the day rather than being all alone in its stall.
You know, one question I want to ask to throw out to anyone of you can answer this, but there, you know, there's a lot of these disorders that all of you characterize in your books that we notice in the animal kingdom. And in some ways, we have such a detailed understanding because with animals, you can't ask them what they're, mm-hmm. why they're doing it. It's all observation based. Mm-hmm. But why does it become so complicated when we try to understand these same things in humans for some reason? You know, the animal kingdom in some ways seems like it would be way harder, and yet we have this sort of almost a deeper understanding of their behavior.
I remember an orthopedic surgeon when I was in medical school tried to cut down, you know, in medicine there's all these hierarchies. It's not just that physicians look down on veterinarians. Different kinds of physicians look down on other kinds of physicians. I'm sorry if there are any orthopedic surgeons here, but the orthopedic surgeons kind of look down on the pediatricians. And I remember this guy saying, oh, pediatrics, that's those patients, they can't even talk to you. That's like veterinary medicine. So it's true that, you know, veterinarians can't, there's no language to describe symptoms, but sometimes we assume, we may falsely as physicians assume that what our patients are using words to tell us may be clarifying. But in fact, very often, words can obfuscate, words can deceive, words can actually work against a patient. And some of the greatest learning that I've done as a physician has been through watching veterinarians and animal experts make diagnoses through observation, through patience, through really looking at the environment in a more holistic way than I do at UCLA when things are busy and patients are coming in the door and we're using diagnostic technology and language.
It's almost as if veterinarians have a way of a kind of patience or an observation technique that mm-hmm. is harder to do in the human world where we've got, you're right, so many pressures, deadlines, you know, a line of people waiting to be seen. But with animals, because you have to be patient, it sort of allows you to see things in a different way.
They also tend to take an environmental approach too. So they're not just going to look at that one patient and then delve down. They're going to look at the social environment around that patient, the built environment, the time of year it is, what season, what they're eating, their nutritional environment.
Go ahead.
It's a really contemporary notion that we need to talk to someone in order to understand their emotional suffering. So, you know, that really dates back to barely over 100 years, not even.
You mean it's like a formal talk therapy?
Exactly. I mean, I really think until the early 20th century, really the reigning idea of how you would diagnose emotional suffering in somebody else was to watch them. And there was a much thinner line between the so-called physical and emotional. You know, so I think, you know, what your work is doing in a really lovely way is sort of bringing those things back together. And in a lot of ways, it's like the new 19th century again, you know, when we are trying to argue now, but using science for a more holistic approach to understanding suffering and how to make sense of it. And that maybe actually we don't have the words for what we're going through. And in that case, you can look at a tiger, or you can look at a person, and you can infer fairly.
Mm-hmm. So that actually brings me to a point I would love to talk to you a little bit about and have you explain. You talk a lot in your book about how animals throughout history have been kind of a mirror of how we see ourselves as humans, and that the sort of disorders we impose on animals to try to explain their mental state actually reflect a bit about what we are going through and how we want to see ourselves. Can you explain that idea? Maybe pick one of the examples you give in the book and explain how it changed over time as we both changed our views of humanity and animals.
Sure. I mean, now, for example, a dog or, you know, in a zoo situation, a gorilla may be diagnosed with a mood disorder and given, say, Lexapro and a behavioral training regime. But 100 years ago, that definitely wouldn't have been the case. And it turns out, you know, that we have trends in medicine, just as we do in everything else. And it turns out that when, say, humans were suffering from mortal homesickness, in the late 19th century, in the early 20th, we were surrounded by animals who were suffering from mortal homesickness, too.
Wait, what is mortal homesickness?
So homesickness, like nostalgia, was considered a physical ailment that could kill you. And it was particularly dangerous in the Civil War. Some soldiers weren't allowed to listen to certain music because it was liable to hurt them. And they may be ill and they may not be able to fight. And so certain songs, like Home Sweet Home, were banned.
Mm. And then that behavior was seen in animals.
In animals. Mm-hmm. So really at any time in history, if you go look at, you know, say an epidemic of a certain kind of human suffering, particularly emotionally, you can find a shadow example in the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. And so what I think we're seeing now, you know, is now that humans can be diagnosed with anxiety disorders and OCD and all these other things, we're now, of course, diagnosing those things in our pets. And maybe, you know, I haven't seen ADHD yet. You know, that's a current hot one. but it may happen. You know, internet
I feel like
addiction.
Dogs invented ADHD. Well,
there's a certain species. I mean, yeah. Some breeds, rather.
Yeah.
Dogs invented ADHD.
Definitely.
Yeah, one of my favorite examples in your book is you talk about, and I've been telling everyone I meet lately about this, a gorilla named John Daniel, who was, in the 19th century?
19-teens.
Living in London with a family. Tell us just a real quick synopsis of his life and how mortal heart sickness played into his death eventually.
Sure. John Daniel was a baby gorilla. He was kidnapped in Gabon, and he was brought to a department store in London to be a Christmas present for some lucky person. And so he was put in the front window of an apartment store downtown London, and a woman and her uncle came by, and they saw him, and they bought him, and they brought him home, and he lived like a human child inside this London apartment. This was like 1918. And what was so amazing was, but before John Daniel, everyone thought gorillas were bloodthirsty brutes because the only people who were seeing gorillas and giving reports of them were people who had gone to Africa to hunt them. So they were really only seeing these Pacific vegetarians when they were trying to kill their babies or kill them. And so, of course, they were getting upset and angry and were aggressive. So John Daniel was really the first gorilla to teach the Western world that gorillas were nice, and that they were friendly, and that they weren't aggressive. And he played the drums, and he ate jam on toast, and he liked tea. He traveled in a train. I mean, he put stuff in the trash can. He really lived with his family for 3 years as a human child, and he was becoming, though, a male silverback. And so the woman who took care of him, you know, who really was his mother, was very worried that he wouldn't be able to live in London as a citizen. So she started to put the word out to see if she could find a home for John Daniel, and someone answered, and she thought she was giving him to someone who would give him a long life in a garden. And it turned out it was Ringling Brothers Circus in New York. And so he was put on a steamship, and he went to New York, and he got here, and he was put in a tower, the old Madison Square Garden in New York. This was 1921, and thousands of people came to see him, and he was so sad, and he stopped eating, and he just sat like legs crossed on his little metal bed and stared out, scanning the crowd for people that he knew. And this was front page news, actually, of the New York Times. Gorilla homesick scans crowd for family. Maybe will die of mortal homesickness. And, you know, this was unfolding on just in the wake of World War I. And so mortal homesickness was a common disease. You know, this was something people were worried about. For the first time in history, humans and other animals could be far enough from home that they could be homesick on a massive scale. And so I think he's a perfect example of that. And historian, sadly, I think he's an ape hero. We should all remember.
And, you know, as you mentioned, as we have developed our own senses of what we're suffering from now, we may call it, you know, depression, for instance, or anxiety. So have the ways we've looked at our animals. And, of course, today it's very in vogue to treat these things with medications. And you talk about that in your book, how we've basically taken Big Farm to the farm. And animals now are just as likely to be using medications. Maybe not just as likely, but it's also very common. We see animals using medications. How big is that industry these days?
Oof. I mean, animal pharmaceuticals is a gigantic business. I think an estimated $9.25 billion by 2015. This is a huge mega industry. you know, how much of that is psychopharmaceuticals is a little hard to tell, because people give their dogs psychopharmaceuticals that they fill at CVS or Walgreens because it's usually cheaper. My dog wound up with a Prozac and a Valium prescription, and I filled it at Walgreens because it was cheaper than filling it at my vet. So it's a little bit hard to figure out those sales because they're lumped in with the human sales. But it's extensive. And, you know, I think, you know, one in five Americans is now taking a psychopharmaceutical drug of some sort. So it's in a lot of ways not surprising. We've always treated our animals with the medications we use ourselves. And in fact, most of these drugs were treated on them, were created in them in the first place. So in a lot of ways, we're just returning these drugs to their original users.
So that's one way in which at least a treatment that we developed first for ourselves has then become something that we are helping animals recover from various illnesses with. But one thing I love about the Zubiquity book is that you talk about all these examples where we do the opposite, where, like you said, the animals showed us the way to recovery first, and now we're trying to find a way to bring that back to the human medicine. I love every time we get to chat, because both you, Catherine, Barbara, have new examples. And I wonder, what's a new example? What's something that you've recently discovered where we've learned something from the animal kingdom that we're now trying to move back to the realm of human medicine?
Well, the one that pops to mind isn't exactly new, but it's kind of new news, which is, you know, the obesity issue. So Catherine and I were visiting with the dean of Ohio State's vet school a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about, and we've visited all these vet schools in, you know, Kansas and Iowa, the breadbasket states. And we were talking about the use of antibiotics, the widespread, industrial use of antibiotics for growth promotion. And his name is Dr. Lonnie King, and he was very proud to talk about the progress that the United States has made in following Europe in beginning to move away from this profligate use of antibiotics for the purposes of growth promotion. And he said, you know, we use antibiotics to make animals gain weight. And then we're surprised when these antibiotics are in, you know, the water and in our food, and we humans eat them, and we gain weight. At which point, Catherine and I asked him, we said, Lonnie, do you think that a significant part of the human obesity epidemic is related to industrial antibiotic use? And this venerable, you know, very major guy, he just began nodding deeply. And it was a very profound moment, because it suggests that what they are doing now in farms, these kinds of important, I believe, important changes, will impact what couldn't be a more significant human problem. And I mean, time will tell, but it will be it'll be interesting to watch.
You know, we're going to have the audience ask questions here in just a moment, so start getting your brain cells fired up and see if you have a good question. But before we let the audience, you know, tear into our guests and ask them all sorts of gripping questions about animals. You know, you wrote books that are somewhat similar and cross over a lot of the same territory. I would love to hear what questions you have for each other. Laurel, you know, you quote Catherine and Barbara's book in your book.
Absolutely.
So you've obviously read their book. What's a question that you would love to ask them now that you're sitting here with them, you know, on stage?
Well, because I'm a big fan, I really want to know what their next project is, but I don't think that they can say that. So I'll save that question for later when our mics are off, maybe. I get them drunk. What do I want to know? Both of you guys have kids. I guess I'm curious. You've spent so much time thinking about the overlaps between how we take care of ourselves and how we take care of the creatures. And I'm curious if any of your own personal experiences have changed by virtue of your research, particularly when it comes to raising your own families and also the animals that you may live with.
Some of my favorite conversations are talking with veterinarians about how they raise their kids. And we had one veterinarian tell us that if she had to, she could clicker train a baby to roll over whenever she wanted it to.
Awesome.
So that was a very useful piece of information.
Still a best-selling book.
Exactly. But I would probably go to a slightly philosophical place with that question, which is just that, again, this profound connection that I felt. I grew up with dogs and rabbits and cats, and hamsters and hermit. I had lots of pets growing up, and they were always part of my life. But it wasn't until I wrote Zubiquity that I really felt like we were deeply connected in the like at the level of our DNA. And there's something special to me about that.
You guys have a question about animal madness that you've been reading?
Wait, I want to hear Barbara's answer.
Barbara.
The answer you touched on are pets, right? And I have to say, we it's a mostly adult audience, so I'll just say we did write a chapter about animal sexuality and the diversity of sexual activity including non-procreative sexual activity among wild animals and domestic animals. And we have two dogs, a male and a female dog, both neutered and spayed at the appropriate ages. And yet they have a true love affair that includes a diversity of activity. And as we were researching this and learning a lot, because I knew nothing about it, it was interesting to see this at home. And just kind of opened my eyes yet again that why would I assume that only the human animal would engage in these kinds of activities? So, one question I have, we're embarking on field work, and your field work seemed exciting and fun. And were there challenges? We have each other, but you were out there in the field and...
Yeah, you guys make me want to write another book with a friend, you know? It looks
it's
so
pretty
fun.
Great.
I spent a lot of time by myself. Fieldwork was amazing. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Thailand while researching this book, which was a lot of fun. I was in Mexico. I really went all over the place to find people and who had devoted their lives to trying to cheer up other animals, mm-hmm. basically. I have family in the audience. They can attest. I have had every parasitic infection known to man.
Let's not do that.
most of them are really itchy and are done now, thankfully. It's just wonderful. I was always wrong. I mean, you know, I set off on all of these adventures thinking I would find one thing and then I would get there and I would spend months and I would realize I had no idea what I was doing. And most things that I had set out when I, you know, like, oh, I will go to this province in Thailand and I will find this person who obviously cheers up elephants using this herb and this thing. And, you know, I'd get there and like they were clearly not doing that thing, but I learned something else.
That's
it was deeply humbling and it was so much fun. Mm-hmm. I'm now thinking about the next book and I don't have another 7 years. This was based on my dissertation mm-hmm. research. And so now I'm thinking about, my God, how can I do this in three? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm actually going to have to be efficient. And that's scary because I don't think field work is efficient. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a lot of like showing up and being curious and making friends with people and like hoping someone connects with you.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're observing animals.
Yes.
They're not just going to do their thing on
it's TV. Mostly involves snacks. Yeah. So. Well, it's like going to
hiding.
Someone's house
yeah.
for dinner.
Yeah.
Like you would never show up without a bottle of wine. I can tell you never go meet an elephant you don't know without a present.
Yeah. That's like, so do they like red or white? What do you recommend?
Sugar cane. Anything made with sugar cane.
That sounds human.
Yeah.
So I think we're ready for the audience Q&A part of the evening. And... there will be people coming around with microphones. They will grab you and have you answer your question. So we'll wait for them to find someone.
Thank you very much for a very fascinating discussion. I'll relate it to my dear dog, Tina, when I get home. But my question is there a danger, or what is the danger to both animals and humans for the human tendency to anthropomorphize animals? And do you find yourselves having to fight that tendency yourself in your research?
That's a great question. I actually had that on my list, so thank you so much. I didn't have time for it.
Well, can I jump in? So I think a lot of us here, when we went to school, we were raised scientifically not to anthropomorphize. It was an admonishment that it was not scientific, it was sentimental, it was about projection, and we should avoid it. And I wanted to be an A student, and I tried to avoid it. But as Catherine and I started working on this project, we realized quickly a couple of things. A lot has happened scientifically since the 1960s when I was in elementary school, and in the 1980s when I was in medical school, a lot. We now know through neuroimaging, through genomic analysis, I mean, the molecular biology revolution, how conserved, that is, how overlapping is the neurophysiology of at least mammals, and even with even some reptiles. Really, we're talking about over 200 million years of highly conserved neurophysiology and brain biology in some cases. So I think that fact wasn't known. It wasn't when I was in elementary school. On top of that, we're looking at these disorders that Laurel and Catherine and I write about, these compulsive disorders where dogs are given Prozac or Zoloft and they get better. Or hallucinating, we talk about hallucinating animals who are given anti-hallucinogenic drugs and they get better. And we begin seeing evidence and evidence that there are significant overlaps, that the real danger may not be in anthropomorphizing. The real danger may be in our kind of a human exceptionalism that makes us blind to overlaps. I say that with caution because, of course, we are not, all species are not the same. But there is certainly much, much, much more overlap than there is difference. And until very recently, there has been a real scientific tendency to parse out the difference and look at that alone without noting the similarity.
It's almost as if maybe we should stop anthropomorphizing humans so much. And might help us observe a little better. You actually, in your book, you say it's important we anthropomorphize well. Not, you know, that we should be careful of this divide, but we should do it in the right way. What do you mean by that?
Well, I actually don't think we cannot anthropomorphize, because I think, you know, it's not as if as a human you can take your brain out of your human head and put it in a jar and then use it to think about other animals' thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, we will always be a human wondering about the experience of another animal. And so I think we can choose to do that critically and well, or we can choose to do that poorly. Mm-hmm. And like, we all know someone who does it poorly. Like, you know, I spent a lot of time on message boards of people who heal squirrels, and, you know, I spent way too much time. It's fascinating, but there's like this war among the squirrel rehabbers, mm-hmm. between the people who put their squirrels in outfits and the people who don't put their squirrels in outfits, and they're really judgy above each other. And I think, you know, that there, you can see this in miniature. You know,
wait, are the outfits like therapeutic?
No.
Okay.
Just like little hats
to the humans.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm being funny, but, you know, this is true. And I think when it comes to your pets, like your dog, Tina, I think that actually anthropomorphism is the right thing to do, because I think no one knows your animal better than you. So even if you take your dog to the vet and they're there for 20 minutes, like you, the compassionate dog companion, know your dog, and you know your dog's normal, and then you will know your dog's abnormal. And so actually identifying and anthropomorphizing with an animal that you love and know well is going to help you help them. So I don't think that's something we should be scared of. But maybe don't put them in a hat, unless they like it.
All right, our next question.
Wonderful discussion. Most of the neuroses that y'all talked about were in either captive animals or domestic animals. To what degree do these neuroses occur, if you're aware, in the wild? I would assume to a much lower degree.
I really wanted to answer that question, because I do feel like, you know, a lot of people know that an animal who is abused or neglected, just like a human, is going to develop psychological problems and have emotional distress. But actually, you know, it's harder to look at in a wild population, precisely because you don't know when whatever their normal behavior has shifted away from whatever their normal is, right? But I did talk to a number of orca researchers. I talked to a lot of marine mammal folks who really do believe that wild animals can suffer from, you know, the equivalent of an emotional thunderstorm in a person. And, you know, you can see, and we have documented for hundreds of years, frankly, self-destructive behavior in dolphins and whales in free-living species. Certainly now, you know, there's a great new book out looking at about naval sonar and the relationship to strandings, and that's possible, but we've been seeing these like mass deaths or self-destructive behavior in other animals long before we were using, the Navy was pinging sonar through the ocean. So in the book, I do have some examples of wild animals who seem to be suffering from various forms of mental disorders.
And also, even if maybe they aren't full-blown, it's that spectrum behavior that we talked about, that something that might be normal or soothing or self-soothing gets dialed up, and you can start to see the roots of that in the wild.
We were very curious about that question also, and we asked a wildlife biologist, he's actually a veterinarian who works up in Alaska, we asked him about polar bears and pacing, because a lot of bears in zoos do a lot of pacing. We said, we assumed that was exclusively captive, and he said, it's interesting, when you see a bear on an ice floe, a polar bear on ice floe, they have a kind of pacing pattern. So the fundamental, the neurophysiology that underlies what we see in the, you know, in a captive environment perhaps is there. As Catherine said, though, it just may be getting dialed up, different kinds of stress.
All right, we have another question here.
Hi. Through all of this research and your journeys of writing the books, I'm wondering how it changed you, or if it changed you on an emotional level in terms of any kind of activism or anything that, I haven't read the book yet, and maybe the answers are there, in terms of what you saw and how you felt emotionally with the animal, and how perhaps what you could do to help them.
That's a good question. Let's start with you, Laurel. How did it change for you how you approach animals, learning that there was so much sort of similar to us going on in their minds?
I mean, I am not just saying this because, like, I am on book tour or something, you know, but I am a different person. Like, I tried everything that I could to help my dog, and it didn't work. And it changed my life entirely around. You know, I went from like a Bernese mountain dog to literally the entire animal kingdom really quickly, and spent the better part of a decade wondering about this, all because of my one dog. You know, and I everything is more interesting to me now, you know, because of this piece where I don't even look at wild animals the same anymore. You know, when I'm looking at, I was in Mexico this year with the ballenas amistosas, or the friendly gray whales in Mexico, which are really amazing. And, you know, you look at a pod of whales and you wonder who's the super affectionate one. Mm-hmm. And you wonder who's the one that's like mildly phobic of boats.
Totally. Or who just had a bad day, or got rejected, or a little bit hungry and getting cranky.
Exactly. Yeah. I look at pigeons. Yeah. You know, I mean, it just makes the world so much more interesting.
You know, that reminds me of, so as a physician, I'm still a practicing physician at UCLA, and Catherine and I, we covered the emotional issues in our book, but we also looked at cancer and heart disease. And one issue which a lot of people, a lot of us and our families are affected by is breast cancer. And it's obviously not a mental illness, but it was really very profound to learn that breast cancer is common in certain animals, big cats particularly, certain big cats, jaguars and lions and tigers. Some of them actually have the BRCA1 mutation, which is seen in Ashkenazi Jewish women, I mean, and among others. There are even some dog breeds that have BRCA1 and have breast cancer and ovarian cancer associated with it. So those kinds of connections, which were a complete surprise for me, were deeply affected me as a physician and as a woman.
Catherine, you want to add something?
I think seeing the world in a different way, definitely. We didn't write Zubiquity as a way to tell anybody how to live their life, but I think that that anytime we can engage deeply on this conversation and where that line is between humans and other animals, which shifts over time and shifts with culture, I think it's important. I think we need to be talking about it all the time.
One thing I read recently, or maybe I heard it on public radio, I can't remember, from you, was that your work doing this book has made you a more interesting zoo goer.
Yes.
And I love the example you gave. Can you just explain why that is and what you do now at zoos?
Sure. So I spent a lot of time sort of skulking about zoos, both talking to keepers and veterinarians who work in zoos, but also just being an observer and watching how humans interacted, and also, you know, making my own little notes about what I was observing on the other side of the bars and the glass. And, you know, we touched on it before, but one thing that captive animals suffer from, you know, terribly is boredom. And I hate using that word boredom, because that almost blames the victim in some ways, which is like, oh, it's your fault, you can't keep yourself interested, you know, which is like, but that's not fair, you know, for a captive animal, because it's worse than boredom, because we've taken away their ability to entertain themselves in a lot of ways. We've taken away the daily challenges and stimuli they would be facing in the wild. So, you know, one thing that I found interesting, and so many people I would talk to chatted about, is how to engage the animals on the other side of the glass. And, you know, great apes are maybe an easy place to start, but a lot of gorillas will react to you if you're just not boring. So most of us are the same. We go to the zoo, we pull out our phone, we stand there, we wave at them, we always wave at them. You know, we remark to our friend, like, wow, the gorilla looks just like us, and then we move on to, like, you know, the shop or to get a snack or a churro or something. But if you stand there and you do something different, it can be amazing. And a lot of gorillas will react if you hold up human babies to the glass. A lot of animals will actually do this. And particularly many animals in American zoos now were hand-raised. And so in a lot of ways, they're more reactive and interested in humans than they are in sometimes their own species. And that's sad, but it's also a way where you can cheer them up and where you can get them to interact with you in fun ways. I always take a harmonica, for example, to the zoo or to the aquarium. And, you know, YouTube is full of these videos. Go home and Google, like, mariachi beluga. You know, it's amazing. But yes, I challenge you to try and actually entertain the animals who are made to entertain you, because it flips the script a little bit, and you'll have a much more enriching experience.
I just have to tell you, we, this is really reminding me. So Catherine and I have been, we started something called the Zubiquity Conferences, where we bring together veterinary schools and medical schools and veterinarians and physicians and animal psychiatrists and psychotherapists and and we have, you know, a case of an animal with self-injury and then a human with self-injury, and we have the animal expert comment on the human animal, and we have the physician comment on the animal. And we do this, we've done this in a number of cities and countries now, and the last one we had was in New York, and we held it at the Bronx Zoo. And one of the cases that was presented was an elderly gorilla who had had a seizure disorder. And the case was presented. We had this very, very prominent epileptologist from New York presenting, and we had an animal neurologist. And it was a room full of DVMs, of veterinarians and physicians in the audience. And so the case was presented like a real, you know, the patient was a 35-year-old, you know, silverback, blah-blah-blah. And up went the CT scans. You've seen Grey's Anatomy or ER, you know, the CT scan always goes up on the hot box and everybody's looking at the CT and all this. And the classroom where the case was being presented had this glass wall. And on the other side of the glass wall were the gorillas. And it's this, the Bronx Zoo is an amazing place with this extensive, you know, beautifully enriched display. And the gorillas started coming closer and closer until they were on rounds with us, looking through the glass at the CAT scans. So it's good not to only to entertain, but to educate.
That's the conference I want to go to. It's like your Zubiquity Interspecies Conference.
All right, next question. Let's keep them coming.
Thank you very much. A fascinating topic. Since we've been talking a bit about zoos, that's one of the places we interact with animals other than pets and large farm animals, I guess, in this country at least. Do you have a sense that, I understand that zoos obviously provide a really great conservation tool and research tool, but for the animals that are brought into a zoo environment, is it in a sense a prison, a captive environment that, you know, as with a human being, if you take a human being and put them in a prison, their behaviors are going to change because of that captivity. How much are the animals that are being put into zoos suffering from what human prisoners might suffer from for essentially what's a life sentence?
That's a you know topic for a larger discussion, and I'm sure. But briefly, first of all, zoos now. I mean, zoos are changing. What zoos were, you know, even a decade ago or two decades, or certainly 50 years ago, very different. And there are responsible situations and less responsible. But the very progressive, responsible zoo community, full of conservationists, biologists, are doing really crucial work that is helping species survival, working with endangered and highly endangered animals, and work that, frankly, is being funded locally, but the results of it, the research, the outcomes are being distributed internationally to benefit animals who are in situ, as not just in captivity. But, you know, it's a complicated question. But I can tell you that this question, which is so important, is on the minds of the experts who are entrusted with the care of these animals. This is part of their discussion. How can we enrich these animals? How can we improve these environments? I mean, the reality is that for many, if not most, of the animals who are in captivity now in zoos and aquariums, they are highly endangered. Many of them are now actually endangered. So there is no kind of take them back to the wild. I mean, that is, it's really an existential question at this point. So it becomes a really an important and philosophical question for us as members of the community. But how are we going to take care of these animals? How can we improve the environment? How can we reduce their suffering? I don't have an answer, but that just wanted to frame it in that way.
Can I say something just because I think we need?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. I think we disagree on this point, so I think we can have a good discussion about it, which is that, you know, I dislike zoos greatly, and I think that they are in many ways, you know, a Victorian form of entertainment that we have outgrown. That said, I completely agree. I think that there is so much fascinating research. I think in many ways, you know, I feel like I'm anti-war, but I respect the soldiers. You know, I feel like some of the best animal advocates I know work in zoos. I have never met a zookeeper who wouldn't, frankly, you know, sacrifice their life nearly for their charges. But I don't think that they're working. When it comes to funding conservation on a global scale, I don't think seeing an animal in activity, in captivity, has turned out to make someone go home and make them support conservation. Many of the most endangered species in zoos today have been in zoos for over 100 years, and people have been going and seeing them, and seeing a panda hasn't made them contribute to conservation back home. I also think often these animals are martyred for the sake of their species, that one gorilla is made to stand in for all gorillas. And if that one gorilla was making people identify with gorillas and go home and, you know, support the Fosse Foundation and everything else, that would be great, but it hasn't turned out to be true. You know, we live in an imperfect world, and I agree that these animals, they can't go back to the wild. You know, their wild doesn't exist. But most of these facilities are engaged in captive breeding programs. And I think, you know, I would much rather see us turn our zoos into places that are retirement homes, where people can live out their lives and, you know, excuse me, where the animals can live out. Definitely Freudian. Where the animals can live out their lives in peace, but we wouldn't necessarily be making them breed. And, you know, I think it's complicated. I think some animals do quite well. You know, I try to deal with this in the book in a way where I think, you know, some zoos are prisons and some zoos are luxury hotels. The problem is that we can't figure out which animals are going to like hotel life before they're there, and then they can't check out. So that's my own personal. Good to debate it.
All right, we have time for two more questions, so let's get some good ones.
Are there animal deniers like there are climate change deniers?
You guys get that one.
When we started, we have a pretty significant grounding in evolutionary biology for our work, because we really wanted to make sure that it was scientifically credible and that we traced the shared genetic and physical history across species. And I would say that we were maybe thinking that there might be some denial on that front, if you want to look at animals that way. But I don't know about climate and animals.
So what do you think is the holdup that sort of is preventing more of this sort of ubiquitous approach to medicine? I mean, you've talked about the way that veterinarians and human doctors have sort of been segregated. Is that starting to break down more? And are you seeing more of this approach? Or is there still somewhat of a barrier? And what is it?
Yeah, well, we're trying. We're you know, creating conferences. We try to bring vet students to the hospital. We teach courses on comparative medicine, and we're trying to. Most of the resistance, you know, we thought maybe we'd, you know, get people activated around, you know, evolution, but I think most of the resistance is cultural. Veterinarians, it's harder to get into vet school than medical school, and veterinarians have very similar training to physicians and become oncologists and cardiologists and psychiatrists. But the two fields are very separate. I lectured to some fourth-year medical students at UCLA last week, and I asked them, how many of you have ever collaborated with a veterinarian? How many of you have ever read a single veterinary journal? And not a hand went up. So we're trying. I think it's a matter of time. But we have to first show, talk about, have conversations like these.
All right. More books. Keep them coming. Yeah. We'll get there.
They need to know that every one of their drugs was tested. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything they do is based in veterinary science.
Mm-hmm. Wow. These have been great questions, by the way. You're a great audience. Last question. Here we go.
Hi. Thank you so much. This is such a wonderful conversation. And since you all have come to appreciate our similarities and how connected we are, how connected we are to animals, other animals, and, you know, ourselves, what are your thoughts on stopping animal testing? I think it's, I'm an RN, and I think it's highly abused. And
these are just mm-hmm. tough questions being lobbed your way.
I'm going to return to the idea that it's an absolutely crucial conversation, and the conversation about zoos and captive animals. And I mean, if you want to keep going, you could talk about pets or, you know, like whatever, citizenship for animal, whatever it is. We absolutely need to keep talking about this. It's I think in a particular state of flux at the moment, and I think it makes us better people and more correct to always be thinking about it.
I also think sometimes these things become one or the other, like let's stop animal testing or let's keep animal testing. And I feel like that's, for me, not the most interesting part of the conversation, because I think there's currently literally millions of animals being tested upon as we sit here. And so there's some really small things that we could do just to make it better tomorrow. Without getting into a very large conversation about whether it should exist or not. You know, I think housing social primates by themselves is unfair and cruel and is not probably going to give you good study results because those animals are suffering. It is, in fact, working on a prison population where it's probably compromising the science. So, you know, I think it's paying more attention to the natural history of the animals, and that leads to better welfare, and that will in turn lead to better science. You know, some of the stuff is legislated, like, you know, primates need to have a mirror now, or a toy, or beagles have to be left out of their cages for a few minutes, you know? I mean, in some ways it's starting to change, but not enough. I would love to see a world in which an animal's natural history and their needs, both emotional and physiological, are taken into account before they become a subject.
It's complicated, and but it's true. And one of the things that's very heartening is that that these kinds of conversations are actually, again, are happening in hospitals. I hear these conversations among people who are entrusted with the care of animals, and I think that's important. It's not black or white, and it's for the most part. I'm sure there's some evil people somewhere, but for the most part, at least in the research environment, it's a conversation that needs to happen. It needs to be scientifically rooted. And one of the most kind of, in a certain sense, elegant and uplifting aspects of this is whatever progress we do make scientifically through biomedical, all kinds of biomedical science, has to be applied not only to human patients, but also to animal patients. You know, we humans are not the only patients on the planet. And one of the aspects of our project is to make sure that what happens on the human side does get pushed out to take care of cats that have breast cancer and osteosarcoma, bone cancer that affects large breed dogs, and so on and so forth.
This is just fascinating information in general, and it really, you know, as humanity, we've taken all this time to sort of figure out the ways we distinguish ourselves to sort of, you know, point out our uniqueness in the world. And I think the work that you all are doing is really great because in a way it's sort of leading us back into the animal kingdom and helping us realize our place, which has always been there, but that we may have choose to forget or sort of overlooked as we sort of saw ourselves as this wayward son off the tree of life. So mm-hmm. I congratulate you on great books and thank you for coming and sharing this conversation with the audience. It's been great. Let's give them a round of applause.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.